move on to the final session for today, and we will try to look at a few more myths and see whether they should be busted or confirmed. Okay, this one, myth number 5. Last my moment determines your rebirth. Okay? So this is something which, again, is very characteristic of certain Theravadan teachings, and it's taught so many times and so often. And I must admit, I find this particular one a bit puzzling. Like most of the kind of the myths and so on, I can understand why they are there and why there's this what the confusion is about. But with this particular one, I find it difficult to understand why actually anybody cares about it. But anyway, so the idea is this, that you live your whole life doing good things every day, and then when you die, you have a nasty, evil thought, and then bingo! There you go. I mean, it's not quite as crude as that, okay? I mean, the teaching in Theravada is more nuanced than that, but this is basically the idea. And just a few things just to clarify conceptually. First thing to understand is that the very idea of a mind moment, okay, is a late Abhidhamma idea. It's not found in the suttas. It's not even found in the canonical Abhidhamma texts. It's only found in the later Abhidhamma texts, okay? So sometimes it could be rephrased as being like the last thought determines your rebirth, okay? So that's another way of putting it. But certainly to understand that the mind moment is an Abhidhamma concept, it's not relevant in the suttas. Now, of course, what the suttas do talk about is they talk about the karma that we make every day. And right at the beginning, we looked at little verse from the Dhammapada saying like a full pot is being filled with the drips of water. And this kind of idea that what are we doing? What are the choices we make every day? Surely that's what it means, right? To have a good life, right? Is how we're going to be living every day, and what's the quality of the choices that we're making every day? That's what's important. And the whole idea of a last thought or a last mind moment, I just find it weird why people kind of obsessed about it. So some of you may not quite get what I'm talking about, because if you but this is something certainly in traditional Theravadan countries, it comes up all the time, right? People keep on asking me about this. Anyway, I find it a bit weird. Anyway, but the thing is, one thing to remember is that karma, and this is something which gets overlooked so many times, is karma is about an ethical choice, okay? It's not a thought, right? These are very different kinds of things. And so we have plenty of thoughts all day, right? This thought, that thought, and they come and they go and so on and so forth. And that's just kind of like a buzz in your mind, right? It's kind of like white noise, and it kind of cancels itself out, right? It doesn't have any particular strength to it or force to it. But it's those moments when we make a choice that is when we're making an act of karma, okay? Now, most people, when they're dying, are not actually making an ethical choice, okay? Most people, when they're dying, are lying there kind of zonked out and not really thinking of anything much at all, right? They're not actually making any karma, right? Now, you might be, let's say you might be a dedicated Buddhist practitioner who is lying there on your deathbed and, you know, keeping your meditation in mind and keeping your mindfulness and so on. So maybe, yes, you are making those ethical choices, right? Or maybe the opposite. Maybe you're lying there on your deathbed planning your revenge against your enemy and planning, oh, I wish I can get reborn and kill them again in the next life and so on, right? So yes, you might be actually having those kind of really ethically strong and powerful charged plans and so on at the time of your death, right? But most people aren't, right? Most people are just lying there not thinking of much at all, or maybe they have an accident. You're driving the car down to pick up some milk from the shop. Bingo, you die, right? Well, you're not actually really making any particular karma at that point, right? Now, there are a couple, I think one of the ways that this has got into the Buddhist tradition is that there are a couple of cases in the suttas where the Buddha does talk about the intention you make at the time of death being effective, okay? But those cases are very rare and they're very exceptional. Okay, now the two main examples from the suttas is one is in the Dhananjani Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And Dhananjani was like a corrupt tax collector or something like this, and he'd been kind of, you know, ripping people off and extorting them for money and being a general bad guy for his whole life. But he'd been a friend of Venerable Sariputta before Sariputta had ordained. And when Dhananjani was on his deathbed, Sariputta came to see him and taught him. And this fellow sort of repented from all his bad deeds. He realized that he had done all these things. He confessed it. He decided, took the precepts, and he even developed meditation on his deathbed. And so he went to a very high heaven realm because he made that strong shift. So you can see that's not just a last thought moment, okay? That's somebody who's completely turned their life around at that time, which happens to be when they're on the deathbed, okay? It's a complete shift in their mind and a very genuine and sincere one. So that kind of thing, yes, if that happens to you, then that can condition your rebirth. And on the other side, there's another case that's given, I think it's in the Garmani Samyutta, if I'm not wrong, anyway, somewhere. It talks about a soldier who goes into battle, and you rush into battle with your sword upraised and your mind full of hate and wishing, may my enemies die, may they be killed, may I slaughter them. And when you do that, you yourself are killed. And somebody who dies with that kind of intention in their mind, right, full of hate and violence in their mind, then that can lead to be the karma which determines their rebirth, right? So if it's the case, in those relatively rare cases, when someone is actually making a strong karma at the time of the death, then yes, that can condition your rebirth, okay? But the majority of cases, it's just not really relevant, right? Majority of cases, we're not necessarily making any strong karma at the time that we die. So the karma that's really powerful and that really matters is the karma that we're making every day. Okay? Questions? Refutations? No? Oh, yes. Okay, three at once. Ooh, that's collective karma right there. Killian.
I was wondering if you meant that concept of the last 9 moments, the only thing that matters is connected to the concept that there is no infinity and we can die in the last moment.
It is in some respects, yes, because it's connected with the Abhidhamma analysis of what actually happens when you die. And there's quite a detailed analysis that's given in the Visuddhimagga and some of the Abhidhamma texts about, like that, I'm talking like late Abhidhamma, not canonical Abhidhamma. For those of you who are not familiar, don't know what I mean when I say that, let me just sort of backtrack, and I should be explaining these terms as I go. When we're talking about the early Buddhist texts, I was meaning to talk about that this morning, wasn't I? Okay, early Buddhist texts, we're talking about the suttas, right? The four Nikayas and some of the early books in the fifth Nikaya, most of which was compiled in the time of the Buddha or shortly afterwards, okay? These are what we call the early Buddhist texts. And these are the suttas both found in Pali, but also in Chinese translation and partially in Sanskrit and Tibetan, which also have a similar strata of text. So that kind of range of scriptures is what we're talking about when we're talking about the early Buddhist texts. Now, somewhat after that, maybe around 200 to 400 years after the Buddha died, there was a compilation of scriptures which were meant to be sort of systematizing and explaining and analyzing those texts. So those early texts is what's called the Dhamma, the Buddha's teachings. And so then these other teachings came later which were about the Dhamma, and this is the word for that in Pali is Abhidhamma. The word Abhidhamma really means something like Metta-Dhamma, right? So it's about the Dhamma. And so those canonical Abhidhamma texts, there are 7 of those in the Pali canon, another 7 in the Savasivadin canon, which exists in Chinese translation, a further text in the Chinese canon, independent one, and various other bits and pieces here and there. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the canonical Abhidhamma texts. So these were compiled between 200 and 400 years, roughly, after the Buddha died. So in those texts, those strata of texts, mostly what we see is a sort of a systematizing and analysis of the teachings found in the early Buddhist texts. Okay, there's very little, there's some, but there's very little sort of independent doctrinal development in those texts. Okay, however, when most people talk about Abhidhamma, okay, what they're actually referring to is things that were written at a much later date, which constitute a kind of mature and developed view of that particular school of Buddhism. So in the Theravadan tradition, when they talk about Abhidhamma, usually they're referring to the Visuddhimagga, the Atthasarani is the Abhidhamma commentary, or even the Abhidhamma Sangaha, which was composed about 11th century in Burma. In the Tibetan tradition and Chinese tradition, when they refer to Abhidhamma, they're usually referring to something like Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma Kosha, which is composed again about 4th century or something like that. And so these are the texts which are actually studied in the schools as Abhidhamma texts. Right? So this is why, just to acknowledge that there's a historical difference or evolution from the canonical Abhidhamma to what is usually studied in the schools as the Abhidhamma texts. So this is why this mind moment is found in those later texts, but not actually found in the canonical Abhidhamma. Okay. Sorry, Naya, you had another question.
Yeah. Comment your own individual choice and
action. Yeah.
So, what happens in regards to rituals
and
things that you do on
this pathway? That's another myth. That's coming up.
And what about dedication of merit?
Also coming up. Okay.
The person you were talking about who underwent this conversion on this deathbed very conveniently after leading a life of violence and then went to a heaven realm. It's because of stories like that, and also because one has an idea of being a person that is a kind of a rolling process, that it seems that one imagines, therefore, that the last moment of consciousness is going to inform whatever subsequent moments of consciousness there are, because it's a process, and why should there be a break between the two? And it does concern me, it has concerned me in a very kind of background way, that when my mother died in some great, I would say, disillusionment with the world, the way she behaved well and ended up in great pain, and I could see a very disappointed woman there, and and it's in the back of my mind, how does that are you going to be reborn a depressive person because your last state, you were actually a very disappointed person? And is that going to carry over? Why should you suddenly revert to some form of right state? Wouldn't the process actually relate more to the end time than to the former time?
Yeah, like I said, only in those exceptional cases if you are actually making this from karma at that time, but most people are not. A mood is not karma. Okay? So if the fact that someone's feeling depression or something, that's not a karma. That's just a feeling.
But it's a feeling of, say, you might have great faith, and faith at the last point is destroyed, and anger would arise, and bitterness would arise.
Yeah, even that's not necessarily karma. Yeah? I mean, often will be, because we often act out of those things unreflectively, right? But you can feel anger, right? So this is something we're going to get into later with the discussion more of the psychology of it, right? But an angry mood doesn't necessarily mean you make angry karma. In fact, it can be the opposite, right? I might be very angry with you right now. I might be thinking, why is she asking all of these annoying questions, okay? But because I have a modicum of mindfulness, just a tiny, tiny little bit of mindfulness that I've developed over these 20 years of practicing as a monk, I've got a tiny, tiny bit, enough so that I can still speak in a civil manner to you, okay? Yeah? So I'm overcoming my feeling. My actual intention is to try to be kind, even though I'm boiling with rage inside. Hypothetically, right? So you can see that there's the defilements and the moods and things that we might have. Of course, that influences our karma, right? Most of the time, if we feel anger, we'll make hateful karma as a result of that, right? So of course it influences it, but it's not the same thing. Okay, and we can intervene, and we can change it. So you can, it's the same thing. Like if you feel greed, you walk past the cake shop, you have greed, or you can have greed karma, or you can have renunciation karma, right? The feeling of greed is still there, but you can choose to act out on it or not. Yeah? So, so again, this thing, sometimes it might have an effect, but generally speaking, the most important thing is what we do every day. Yeah. But, you know, maybe your mother might be an exceptional case. It sounds like she went through some pretty major stuff towards the end of her life, so maybe she was one of those unusual situations. Yeah.
But what do you mean when you say making strong karma?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we distinguish between other forms of karma? So are you saying that only strong karma will have results?
And well, at the time of death, yeah. Only kind of a strong karma will sort of have the strength to overpower all the other things you've done through your life, right? So you might be, you know, a good person all of your life, and so that's going to be good karma, right? So you do lots and lots of little acts of kindness, right? But then maybe you can overpower that by committing a mass murder at the end of your life. Right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
Of course, absolutely, the good karma is still not lost, right? But here we're specifically talking about what is that condition, that next rebirth. But again, that's exactly true, that the karma will have an effect now or at some point in the future. It could be any time. Yeah. Yes? Well, that's what I was talking about before, like the example of the corrupt tax collector or the warrior or something like that. Somebody who's making some kind of powerful karma at the time of their death. Yeah. You know, maybe you're trying to save a drowning child and then you drown, right? You're trying your best. So that kind of thing. Yeah. We have two at the back. Which Rooney? Okay.
Right.
Sure. Yeah, so that's, you know, a thought isn't karma. Right? Karma is intention. You might have an angry thought about that person. Do you intend to harm them? Do you actually want them to suffer? She's nodding. Does that mean...
Because you feel
more if they're close to you, you know, they are. Sure. So I wish worse for someone close. But after those, you know, later on, thinking, you know, I don't really want that to happen. Mm. But
this is
the thing, it's a bit of a grey area, right? But generally speaking, if something's like there's a difference between an intention or a plan or something and just some stray thought, okay? So stray thoughts are kind of like white noise. They kind of cancel each other out. There's a buzz there, but there's nothing particularly that's formed or whatever, you know? So, you know, you're in the cafe and the waiter is rude to you or something, and you maybe sort of get a bit annoyed for a minute, but then you forget about it. It doesn't really mean anything, right? So there's a difference between that and actually articulating and going over a thought again and again and again and having a kind of a plan to do something about it, right? I'm going to wreak havoc on them and lay my vengeance upon him for 7 generations. Right? So, of course, it's a grey area, like everything, right? So you can't make a hard and fast distinction. But you don't have to walk around. The point of this is that you don't have to walk around being paranoid that any old stray thought is going to get you reborn in some hell realm. Okay? It doesn't work like that. You have to look at what's your intention, what's the main thing that underlies what it is that you're doing. Sorry? Sure. Well, indifference itself is, again, it's a mood, it's not an intention. Yeah? The intention would be the intention to not do anything to help them. Okay? Can indifference be an intention? Yeah, so again, indifference is a mood rather than intention. Sorry, Rina, you had a question. Please.
About a monk called Thipa. I don't know whether this is from early talk or not. But this monk, he has just received a brand new very fine silk robe.
Yeah.
And he died on the day he received it. and he was very fancy about it. He reborn into
insects.
Ah, yes, yeah.
That on the rock.
Yeah.
Yes, and when other monks trying to divide the rock, it was. Can hear this little voice that says, you know, don't take my rope, don't take my rope. And he came out and said, put that rope aside for 7 days and divide later. And what happened is that insect can live like five for 7 days. And after 7 days, the insect died and can divide. So that the story makes me believe that because he's been practicing a lot, he just happened to be very clean on that rock, and when he died, he feels fancy about it. That's why he was born and feel attached to it. Is that going to be exceptional circumstance?
Well, I don't know. That sounds more like a normal circumstance, doesn't it? That we get very attached to our things. I don't know. I know one time he went around, traveled around America. His monk was supposed to be able to see these kinds of things, and he said he'd never seen so many hungry ghosts as he has in America. Yeah, because people are so attached to their things. Yeah, quite interesting. That's a commentarial story. I'm not sure, you know, how literally we're meant to take it, but yeah, I mean, that's the basic idea, is you get that object of attachment, that object of fixation, and when, you know, if your mind's kind of lingering on it, and, you know, you can think with those kinds of things. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, right? But if you're a monk, you see, you don't really have any things, right? So normally you sort of set up your whole identity and your prestige, right, by your house and your car and what you wear and all this kind of stuff. So if you're a monk, you don't really have all of those kinds of things so much. So you can actually get, you know, very kind of obsessed with a nice set of robes or something like that. And that can be a real kind of marker of status or something like that. Often it's felt that if you have good robes, if you're a monk and you get like really nice robes or something like that, must be because you have lots of good karma in the past, right? That's why you have all of these really nice things in the present. So, you know, that sometimes the attachments can get focused in that way. So yeah, that can lead to that lower rebirth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the population is
glorious,
right? You compare the 200 years ago, maybe population for 10 times or 20 times. So that means some of the people don't have that karma when they are born.
Well, what about animals?
The karma comes from the animals.
Yeah.
That means the animals.
Animals don't have consciousness. Really? Have you ever met an animal? Don't you have a dog?
I don't have a dog.
Oh, you should get one. The dog would bite you for saying that. Sure, animals have consciousness. Yeah, they feel, they have intentions, they have emotions. Yeah. So it's always felt in Buddhism that rebirth can take place in multiple different realms. So in the realms that we can normally see, of course, the human realm. And as you said, the number of the human realms is impermanent. You know, there's more people now. But you can also get reborn in the animal realm. And you know, the number of animals is, there's a lot more animals than there are humans, right? A lot, like if you think of it, how many fish there are in the sea and this kind of thing. Even insects, yeah. So your chances of getting reborn in the human realm are slim at best. Hiya.
Please help me, because I have to sell this. I'm a Buddhist teacher and I have to sell this idea of karma.
Uh-huh.
Because I see so many good people who do really good things, and their life is so hard, you know. I mean, even the Dalai Lama, he still doesn't know his country back, you know. And it's really hard to say to those people who are really at the end of their rope, who are doing good things, and it's not really getting anywhere. Like how you say to them, it's going to come in the next life, and you know, it's just not very convincing to them.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, I can say, well, you know, if you do a good thing, you feel happy immediately and stuff like that. But they're really, I mean, Islam women, right? They're really struggling, and religion is the only thing they have left to give them comfort, you know. So what can I really say to them to, I don't know, you know, to give them a little bit of hope in terms of the idea of karma, you know, and they're not too strong on the idea of future life.
Mm.
It's like really hard to, even some Westerners, you know, it's quite hard to give them the idea of karma that it's not immediate, you know. I don't really know a way around it.
Yeah.
Isn't doing good just in some kind of happiness? And perhaps to promote the sense of doing good without expecting any result. Because otherwise we are then not into business making and leaders. But I know it's very hard to do it on that level.
Yeah.
But still, we see many people even now that how much this is their child and not really expecting much back, and it keeps on their kind of personality.
So is that, sorry, sorry to interrupt, but did everyone hear that?
No.
Okay, so I was saying that shouldn't we just be focusing on the idea of doing good for its own sake? So regardless of, you know, whether you actually accomplish what you want or do good or whether you know future lives and so on, but the fact that when you do a good act, you feel good about doing that. And so maybe that's what we should be focusing on.
But I mean, like, people who are really... they're about to snap, you know, they're, like, I have some young boys who work for me, their fathers are alcoholic, who break their mother's bones, okay, and I've got this young boy sitting in front of me, saying, I meditate, I keep the 5 precepts, why is my life still garbage, you know, and they're this close from just becoming mafia, you know, I'm the only thing between them and becoming mafia, you know, they're so, they're really trying to live a good life, but their life is so hard, and it's really hard for me to just say, yes, in your future life, you'll be all right, you know, and it's, like, so hard for me to, they're in quicksand, you know, and it's so hard for me to pull them out of that.
Yeah.
It's not easy for me to just...
Well, I know, and I don't want to give any easy answers. I don't think there are any easy answers. But in that particular case, I mean, the reality of the situation is that karma is not magic, and it's not going to somehow magically fix all the problems in your life.
Yeah.
And in that kind of case, they don't need good karma. They need a social worker or a prison to get rid of their dad and somehow solve the actual social problem in front of them. You know?
But it's not, you know, the system doesn't work in India, right? So it's not
going to... I know, it's not easy, yeah. I had this conversation with this guy when I was going to Bindabata down in King Street a couple of months ago, or it must have been last year now. And he's this kind of begging on the street corner for money, right? Turns out he, you know, just wants another shot, right? He's just begging for money for a fix. And, you know, I started talking to him and he's like, I don't believe in karma. I said, you know, what's your problem with karma? And he's like, oh, you know, I've done all of these good things and I've, you know, he stayed in temples and monasteries for years and so on and done all of these things and now no one will even give me enough money for my next fix, you know? So, yeah, it's a mixed black and white karma, I guess. Yeah. Look, I don't think there is an easy fix, but I think we have to avoid selling the doctrine of karma as if it's going to be a magical sort of panacea for everyone's ills. You know, it should help people cope if they have a sense of doing good and so on within themselves. But we also sometimes you just need to change the conditions around you.
You know what I found really? The only thing that works is just to love them like a mother and to take them to a place like loving kindness and surrounding them with loving kindness. I'm just taking them to a place for a few hours or a few days where they're away from that and they just feel a sense of being supported and cared for and they feel a sense of peace a little bit away from it. You know, but sooner or later they always have to go back into it because their karma is very strong, you know. But I just found that I can only give them a bit of relief with a bit of loving kindness for a while. That also, I mean, I also have energy limitations on how much I can give and how long I can give them a little bubble.
Yeah,
I think we naturally want to fix things. And going through all the turmoil, and I desperately want to fix. And I think when anybody who seems to have the care to deal with mental health issues, you just want to get them and fix. And do you know what the hardest lesson for me is that I cannot fix it? And I'm a great fixer in my professional life, and I fix problems. And for me, I've had to turn this around in any practice equanimity and be investigated by any response to it. Because otherwise you go mad and you get compassion overload, not compassion burnout. And how we look after ourselves when we want to fix problems, I don't know. Because there are some problems in the world that it doesn't matter what our personal intention is, we just can't fix them. And we can either respond with despair or we just do what we can. I don't have an answer to that. I don't know how are we supposed to prevent ourselves from burning out when we're faced with such suffering and such despair?
I think that's a case of not just teaching the law of karma to other people, but teaching the law of karma to ourselves. That karma is individual. And that there's only so much we can do to help other people. We should do our best, and we can do our best, but we can't beat ourselves up for not being able to live other people's lives for them. Kamma sukhammi, kamma dharmaṃ.
Yeah. I mean, that's... Yes, it's hard when it's your family, but sure, yeah.
Particularly when, since it is possibly the case that we have our family members have given us in previous lives. You know, if that's what seems to be commonly accepted, that the people who are closest to us now, people who we have good bonds with in previous lives. So there's maybe some element of I'm here for a particular reason, and I've got to react in the best way I can because maybe I've done some harm in the past, and I really need to show that I can react differently this time around.
And break the cycle. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do believe that you can make a difference, but what I see is you have to be really skillful about it, like. If I see the people in the slum that they actually respond to what I'm giving and I can get results, although limited results with great personal cost. Whereas if I see my family, I could put 100,000 gallons of energy into it and I'd only get 1 centimeter of results. So I see carefully where I put my energy and what has the most profound results. Like if you only have one life and a certain amount of energy, find a place where you can do the most good. In the most sustainable way. But I also see the extent to which you can help others is also equal to the extent of your own realization, and you need to have a really deep practice and maintain a practice to really be able to help others in a long-term and sustainable way. But I do believe we can do amazing things, and you just need to look at Nelson Mandela and Gandhi to see that it's possible. But no one would say that it's easy, and whether you really want to do that with your life, you know. But I also see that there are individuals who are very much energy vampires, and sometimes you can't help them, they don't change. And you need to take care of yourself and just know, have some boundaries. But sometimes we don't do enough. I think a lot of Western Buddhists don't do enough. We're very navel-gazing. You know, we don't. Maybe it's because we also have a lot of suffering ourselves, you know. But I think...
Yeah, the call to action doesn't seem to be so strongly appreciated.
Yeah, but I see activists who burn out as well because they have no inner practice. So I think it's very much a balance.
Well, that means we've had a negative impact because you know, not have that much self-awareness about what this means.
What is an energy vampire? I can't find it.
What is an energy vampire?
Those people who are so negative and so angry and they suck you, your vital force.
or people with chronic depression, they just, no matter what you do,
you're just left feeling stuck dry. Mm-hmm. Which isn't necessarily their problem, because some people cannot, they can't help it, that's right. But I agree with you, Sister Richard, it's our response under those circumstances is, I guess, the critical matter. Mm-hmm. So, because that's where our calm is made, what is our intention at that point in time. If you've got somebody who's just going to suck you dry, that you want to give, then give it to people who go, oh, this is great, this 2 hours I spend away from my family situation has really turned my life around.
I think we can assign this one. I think we're ready. Bastard. Okay, we'll move on. We've still got quite a few to go for today.
Is there anything that you're going to say is true?
Like maybe. Okay, moving on. I don't want to spoil it, okay? Okay, ritual's a powerful karma, right? So this is this idea that it's something which is very common in the Buddhist tradition, that by worshipping relics that you make for very good karma, or by paying respects to good monks, or that by all of these, doing this chanting and so on and so forth, that you therefore make powerful karma by doing these kinds of things. So just to sort of give a bit of historical background here, the Vedic tradition, right, which was very prominent in India in the time of the Buddha, was all based on the idea of ritual. And in the Vedic tradition, the word karma means ritual, right? And so there's countless invocations and prayers and dedications and all these details about how to perform different rituals and so on and so forth, which was the main part of the Vedic ritual, or at least the traditional Vedic ritual. Now, even before the Buddha came along, within the Brahmanical tradition, there was already a questioning of that and a tendency to undermine the notion of the ritual. We'll look more a bit at the historical context in later times, but we certainly find a tendency to look towards the mind and look towards one's intention and one's consciousness, rather than simply the correct performing of the external ritual. So this is a movement that's already gathering pace before the Buddha appeared. And when the Buddha came along, like most of the other Shramana religions, so the Buddha was not unique in this, but like most of the other Shramana religions, the Buddha simply rejected ritual out of hand, right? The Vedic ritual was simply wiped off the plate, and it wasn't really replaced with anything else, okay? So there's no ritual in early Buddhist texts. Simple as that. Now, there are a few things which are kind of a bit ritual-like, say, people, for example, will bow, but that's more of a sort of a courtesy kind of thing rather than being felt to be a ritual. People would recite texts or do, like, chanting, but again, that was like memorizing. That was an education program. And, you've mentioned that many times. You're supposed to chant the text. You're supposed to reflect on the meanings of them and investigate the meaning of those texts inside yourself. It's not just the reciting of a mantra that you don't know the meaning to. Right? And so it's a fundamental and powerful part of the early Buddhist teachings that the Buddha simply dismissed out of hand all of this ritual. It's impossible to overestimate how important this is. The entire religious thing before the Buddha came along, or virtually the entire thing, was all about ritual, and the Buddha just ignored it, and he just made some snarky remarks about how if bathing in the Ganges would purify you, then all the fishes and turtles would be enlightened, right? So he just sort of he just sort of snarks at that, and he said, the Brahmins, he said, has anybody seen, you say these rituals are such good karma, but has anybody seen this? Has anybody seen the results of it? No. Has your teachers seen this? No. Have your teachers to the seventh generation, have they seen it? No. He said, well, it's like a file of blind men. One blind man's leading the next, and the next one's leading the next. And no, the first one doesn't see, and the middle one doesn't see, and the last one doesn't see. That's how the Buddha described the Brahmanical tradition. Right? So it's pretty, it's pretty in your face, right? It's not as if he was kind of compromising with it too much. However,
there were also times when the Buddha did have more of a conciliatory attitude, in the sense of saying, well, look, there are ways of doing rituals at least which are less harmful. We'll look at some of these later, the Kuta Danta Sutta being a good example. You know, so as long as people weren't doing anything which was overtly harmful in rituals, like, say, slaughtering animals and so on, right? So if they weren't doing anything that was actually harmful, the Buddha didn't, you know, say you have to stop doing your rituals, but it certainly wasn't part of his path, right? So there is a use, and I mentioned this earlier, that the idea of karma, and we find in the Vinaya is like Sangha Karma, and these things have a tendency to become ritual, right? And this is something which is well known to those of us who live in the Sangha, who see how these things work. So, for example, one of the most important things we do, procedures we do in the Sangha, is the fortnightly Uposatha. And so the Sangha gathers together every fortnight. We recite the rules of discipline, so the rules for bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, and we confess our offences, right? Now, what's very kind of striking about this is in that recitation, right? In the recitation itself, it says, quite explicitly at the beginning, it says, if any bhikkhu should remember any offence that they've committed, they should confess it. Saramanena bhikkhu vidhikana. Right? So you should confess an offence that you remember. If you don't confess the offence that you remember, then this is false speech. This is a lie, right? So in that context, to not say anything is actually a lie, okay? If you remember it. But what we actually do in the Sangha is we make these kind of blanket confessions, and these are done in different ways, but every Buddhist culture has them, and you say something like, you know, all of the offences that I've committed in the past and the future, any offence that I've committed or may have committed, that is intentional or unintentional, knowing or unknowing, I confess all of them, okay? So you've confessed all of these offences, which of course means you've confessed nothing, right? And what it means is that what was originally, and then you recite the Padimokkha, the rules of the Padimokkha in Pali, right? Which is great, yeah? For those of us who know Pali, right? It's really good, yeah? Because you know exactly what the rules say and so on. But unfortunately, for those who don't know Pali, which is, even in the Sangha, is a majority, it basically becomes a completely meaningless ritual. And so by adhering, you know, by insisting so much on the external forms of it, right? By saying, oh, we have to recite it in Pali. Actually, this is completely contradicting what the Vinaya itself says. The Vinaya itself says you should teach the Dhamma in your own language. That's why when they took the Dhamma to China, they translated it into Chinese. They took it to Tibet, they translated it into Tibetan. That's what they should have done. Okay? Unfortunately, when they took it to Sri Lanka, they didn't translate it. They kept it in Pali. Which I think is great, because I like Pali. Right? I mean, you know, there's advantages to it. It means that we have, you know, a very authentic set of texts there, right? And that's great. But that's the cost, right? The cost is that then the texts, the rituals all done in Pali, we don't understand what they mean, right? I mean, maybe we do some, like, chanting, iti piso, bhagava, rahang, samba. Maybe you can read that and you know what that means, right? So that's a bit different, right? That's a simple thing. But when you're chanting long lists of rules and stuff like that, you don't really know what they mean. So that's how the kind of the meaning gets leached out of it, little bit by little bit, and it becomes just an empty form. And so you can get together and you can do this chanting, and actually it doesn't really mean anything. So there's always this kind of suggestions that should be reformed, that we should recite it in our own language and these kinds of things, but it's very difficult to get any traction with those things. Ajahn Pramali's done his best to try to do that at Bodhnyana, but even some of that Bodhnyana, we've never really done that. And even when I was running Santi, we never really did it 100%. So these things are it's not easy to shift, but, you know, you can see how there's this tendency within the tradition that the actual things that the Buddha taught forgotten, and all of these rituals and things are put in their place. And that happens incredibly quickly, okay? Don't think that this is something which has evolved over thousands of years or whatever, right? You look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, right? How long did it take? Right? How long it took? The Buddha's ashes weren't cold yet, right? They collect up the relics, they put them in jugs, and they go to war about them, okay? And they're all lining up with their armies to go to war to fight over who can get the biggest share of the Buddha's ashes, That's how long it takes, okay? Until finally someone says, hang on, didn't the Buddha teach us all about non-violence and stuff? Yeah, there was something about that, yeah. Right? So you can see 45 years of teachings, right? Not a single word about relics, worshipping relics or any of this kind of stuff. Not found anywhere at all. It's not part of the Buddha's teachings. 45 years, nada, nothing, zilch, zip, sunya, okay? 5 minutes after the Buddha's death, all they're concerned is to get these relics. And they forget everything that they've been taught for the last 45 years. Yeah? That's how quickly religions go back to this empty form. And another example from my good friend in Bodhnyana, Venerable Upasama, who is one of the most fascinating monks that you're likely to meet. He's a monk who begins conversations with sentences like, this one time I was been fasting in the desert naked for 2 months eating only tomatoes. And he goes on to tell some kind of story. But anyway, he was one of the very first monks who was ordained in America in the late 60s. He was ordained by Suzuki Roshi at the San Francisco Zen Center. He was actually very close to Suzuki Roshi at the time and used to work with him and look after him and be his attendant and all of these kinds of things. And one of the things that they did was that every morning they would go out and do the garden, right? They had a Zen garden and they would clean it and do that. And that was part of their practice, right? And then the Roshi dies. They do the funeral. The next morning, this monk went out to do the garden and the other people in the center said, "What are you doing?" The next day, "What are you doing?" "I'm just doing the gardening." "But that's Roshi's garden. You can't touch that." Yeah. One day, that's all it took. Yeah. And that living garden, right, is now basically just a fossil. Yeah. So this is how we get attached to these forms, these religious forms, these externals, and the life of religion dies out.
So are you saying that Pali chanting and sutras
are useless? I'm saying that if you want to chant sutras in Pali, you should learn their meaning as well. Yeah.
You don't think maybe people will get better if they chant it in their mouth? Would it be better to chant it in English?
Oh, you mean like if you're actually doing the chanting as a ceremony? Yeah. Honestly, chanting, it kind of depends. I think if you're in a traditional Buddhist context, right, then you've sort of been brought up hearing these things being chanted in Pali. So I think there's certainly an emotional connection with it, you know. And so, I don't have a problem. I love chanting in Pali. I much prefer it than chanting in English. And at the very least, you can kind of sometimes just even just create a space where people can sit there quietly and so on. So again, it's this thing that the ritual itself isn't—it's not a bad thing, right? But certainly—is it better to chant it in English? Probably. Yeah. There's always a kind of a tension you find, certainly in the forest tradition in Thailand. Thailand's one of the most kind of ritual-orientated, cultures in the world as far as Buddhism goes, and the forest monks are always sort of pulling back from these rituals, right? There's always this kind of tension, you're always being invited out for funerals and house chanting and this and that, and of course the problem is that the more that you do that, right, the holier you are, right? The more secluded you are, then the more people want you to come for those things. But you see, every forest monastery you see has that tension is always there. Yeah? People are always asking them to go for rituals, go for things, and they're always trying to do less.
Yeah. There's something about the relation that we form in the Buddhist time. People walk around the Buddha and it's transferred
to the Buddha. But again, it was a kind of, that's like shaking hands or something like that. It's a gesture of respect rather than being a ritual as such. I'll give you an example. Like when people would do that for the Buddha, they would circumambulate, they would walk around him, keeping the right side to him, with a gesture of respect, and the Buddha, that was fine. There's another case where the Buddha was visiting the new home of Prince Bodhi, and Bodhi lays down a white cloth for the Buddha to step on,
right? So this is like specifically, it's like an auspicious kind of thing, and the Buddha just stands there and won't step on the cloth. Yeah? So that kind of thing he's not going to do, because that's reinforcing that kind of wrong view. Maybe, I think that might be in the commentary or something, but yeah, maybe, I mean, that's probably fairly plausible. A lot of those kind of rituals are associated with fertility and stuff, which is another thing that we find as monks. I don't know if nuns get this, but, you know, I get this. People come along and say, oh, I'm really wanting to have a baby, you know, can you do some chanting for me? And I'm like... I can give you a talk about the birds and bees or whatever.
If her husband was infertile, if she should do something with a Hindu holy man, then she might get a saint as a child.
Uh-huh. And what was your advice?
I was just too shocked to reply. I was like, maybe you should try IVF.
Yeah.
What kind of charm do you give in such circumstances? And, there's none, my dear, from the sisters.
An embarrassed and short one? I usually do something like the Jayanto. Jayanto Bodhya Mule Satyana.
We still do it, that's okay, we still do it.
Maybe even more appropriate to like a fire sermon or something like that. I don't know.
Make them feel better.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, a little bit of fun makes people better. Yeah. 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 Get some benefit.
It does. People feel better, and that's why people like it. It's one of these things. You know, you don't want to get too, you know, how far you want to go with it. You know, I mean, so I always, you know, I feel I do like water, holy water sprinkling in Perth. You know, it's become a huge thing. Ajahn Brahm does this. Holy water, and because, you know, he goes away and he leaves me there, and everyone comes up and says, you know, can you have the holy water? And I remember one time I was there, and, you know, he's sitting after the meal, right? Everything's finished, he's sitting in the halls, and people come up and see you and talk about various things or ask various questions and so on, right? So this time I had three groups of people come to see me, okay? There was, first of all, this group of Thai ladies who brought dana. It was a Sri Lankan family, and there was a Western guy who was sitting there, okay? First of all, the Thai lady came up and said, oh, can you sprinkle some holy water? So I said, okay, so I do some chanting and sprinkle holy water. And then the Sri Lankan family came and said, can you teach us about dependent origination? Okay? And this Western guy was sitting in the back, and I was sitting to myself, I'm thinking to myself, yes, 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 yes. And then I'm going for the hat trick now. And this Western guy came up and said, oh, look, I'm having real problems with my girlfriend. Can you help me? I said, yes, that's it. Everyone fully lived up to their stereotypes. Okay, let's move on. Let's go on. We won't finish all these. We've still got plenty. Faster! Okay, next. Mahamoggallana's death. Okay, this one I'll spend just a little bit of time on. But for those of you may be familiar, this is something which is quite commonly talked about in the Buddhist tradition, or certainly Theravadan tradition, is that when there's a long, involved story, but just to summarize it, is that Mahamoggallana is the second greatest disciple of the Buddha, and that when he died, he was attacked by these thieves, and then he sort of, you know, escaped, and then that happened again, and he used his psychic powers and escaped and so on. But then after some time, he'd done that two or three times, and then he used his psychic powers, and he saw that he'd done some bad karma in his past life, and he couldn't escape it, so the last time he let the thieves kill him, and then that was the end, right? Something like that's a story. So that's a commentarial story. It's not found in the suttas. The suttas don't say anything about Mahamoggallana's death, okay? Nothing. Right? They mention something about Sariputta's death, but Moggallana is nothing, which is not unusual. I think most of the disciples, we don't find any record of their death in the early Buddhist texts. Ananda, Kassapa, and so on, we don't find anything. So that whole story, I regard as being purely an invention of the commentaries. And again, it's kind of contradicting this whole idea of karma, right? So you just think about it, right? How is it that Mahamoggallana's act in his past life is forcing these criminals to be attacking him, right? I mean, it's ridiculous. If someone's attacking you, it's because of the karma that they're making in the present. They're not being forced by somebody else's karma to do this. I mean, it's just nonsense. right? So this whole idea, I think, is just you know, and so this is where this idea of karma as fate and destiny. It's almost like you do an act and you force the whole world to sort of conform to the act so that you can play out your little events. It's not how karma works, okay? So Mahamoggallana, as far as I know, had just a perfectly natural death, and I don't think we need to take it any further. I might just keep drawing a little bit because we're going to run out. Okay, busted. Bingo. Law of attraction. This one also I'll skip over quite quickly. Law of attraction is the idea that you have this power of positive thinking, right? So I can think positive things. May the abundance of the world overflow in my general direction, okay? And we're going to manifest these positive realities by thinking of these kinds of things, right? But of course, that's not how the world works, right? There are good things and there are bad things, and as we've heard many times, lots of times, people do good stuff and bad things happen to them, and so on and so forth. So, and this is an idea that's very probably more prominent or characteristic in New Age circles and things like that, but I just thought I'd mention it. So from a Buddhist point of view, we take the point of view of dukkha, right? Life is suffering, right? And these things happen. We don't expect it to be any other way. So the idea that you can somehow just sort of manifest all of these positive things, it's just a bit naive, a bit childish, really. Of course, having said all that, of course it's the case that if you are positive, it's a good thing, right? And it tends to be the case that if you have a positive attitude to things, that you can get things done and you attract other people who also have a positive energy to you and so on and so forth. So that's, you know, that's how nature works, right? But it's not some kind of magical force that's going to guarantee those positive outcomes. And what can happen with this is that sometimes people, if they really believe this, they can then get very depressed and they can actually make a lot of very bad decisions based on this. We had a case in Bundanoom when I was there many years ago, someone who was running the cafe, one of the cafes there, and they started it and they were trying to do it as this New Age thing and so on. And they were all into this kind of manifesting positive energy and all of this kind of stuff, but they were losing money left, right and center from their cafe. And they're like, well, what am I doing wrong, right? Same thing can happen when you get sick. Maybe you think, you get ill, and then you're thinking, it must be my fault because I'm determining that, right? And so you can actually lead yourself to make bad and unwise choices, decisions, because you have an excessive and an unrealistic expectation from these things, right? So again, this thing, yes, of course it's good to have positive thinking, be constructive, and that tends to create good outcomes, but it's not a kind of magical force. Okay. Busted. Okay? So here's perhaps a somewhat more interesting one. Karma is a cultural belief. Okay? Now this is something which is commonly heard in secular Buddhist circles, and various people will argue this, that the Buddha only taught karma and rebirth because it was a cultural belief in India at the time. Now, this, of all the myths and so on karma, this is perhaps the most stupid of them all, I have to say. First of all, I don't even know where to start, right? I mean, has anyone met people who put these things? You're wondering, have they actually ever met a human being, you know? I mean, a 14-year-old school child has more than enough critical faculties to be able to understand that the beliefs of people around them may or may not be true sometimes, right? I mean, this is an elementary part of being able to have a mature mind, right? I mean, to imagine that somehow the Buddha lacked the intelligence and critical acumen of a 14-year-old school child, right? It's just so completely bizarre, I don't even know where to begin to start. What we see in the suttas is that the Buddha is constantly interacting with and relating to his culture in an intelligent and mature and critical manner, as you might expect of somebody who's, you know, like enlightened and stuff, right? Right? So he doesn't just believe things because people tell them to him. He will investigate and inquire and say, well, these things seem plausible and we can accept them. These things do not and we will reject them. Yeah? And he will explain the reasons for that and he will put something in a too hard basket and say, we can't know about those things. Other things he will say, this is definitely the case because I've seen it for myself. And in the case of seeing karma and rebirth, this is something which he repeatedly affirmed, that he saw these things with his own direct knowledge. And in fact, this is one of the basic descriptions of the enlightenment is in terms of the devijja, the threefold knowledges, the recollection of past lives, the seeing, clairvoyance, seeing beings passing upon, being passing away and being reborn according to your karma, and finally the knowledge of the ending of defilement and the ending of rebirth, which is enlightenment. So these things, he says, this is absolutely core, it's crucial to the Buddha's own description of enlightenment experience. Right? Many times where he actually explicitly says that these things are not something that he's heard from anybody else, but that he's known and seen for himself. So, quite apart from all those things, right? There's the problem that the cultural view of the time was absolutely not a uniform and accepted view about what karma was, right? There simply wasn't any real widely spread view about karma and rebirth in India at the time of the Buddha. And if we look at the different Shramana traditions, which are described in quite a lot of detail in the Buddhist texts, and to some extent in Jaina and other texts and sources as well, they had many, many different ideas about rebirth. Some of them taught that there's no such thing as rebirth. Some of them taught that rebirth is fixed and that the choices you make don't have any effect on it, and so on and so forth. So that almost any possible idea about rebirth can be found there, not only in the Shramana traditions, but also in the Vedic tradition as well. Yeah, the Vedas have many different theories about rebirth, descriptions of the process of rebirth, which you find in the Upanishads and so on. And occasionally, right, one passage that I'm aware of in the pre-Buddhist texts where they talk about actual karma in the Buddhist sense, right, only one passage that I'm aware of in any pre-Buddhist text. And in that passage, it's very interesting, it's in the Upanishads, they're talking about karma and he says, shh, come with me. He takes him by the arm and leads him to one side, and that's when they talk about karma, right? It's not something that they could talk about openly in front of others, right? It was like a secret teaching at that time. This is about maybe 200 years before the Buddha, something like that. Why was it a secret teaching? Because the doctrine of karma was explosive, okay? It undermined the whole Vedic tradition, right? No longer, this is what the Buddha was saying, if you follow through the implications, which you find in the Dhammapada, somebody's not a Brahman because of their birth, they're a Brahman because of how they act, right? So you've immediately destroyed the fabric of the whole Vedic culture, right? And so this is a very controversial idea, it still is in India today, right? And so that's the reason when it emerged within the Brahmanical tradition, right, whether it came from an evolution within the Brahmanical tradition or whether it was introduced to it from outside. I think perhaps it was introduced to it from outside. But in any case, at the time of the Buddha, it was still a very marginal idea. And it's only much later that we find that in the Indian traditions, the surviving Indian traditions, yes, did mostly just accept the idea of karma and rebirth. Ultimately the successful Indian traditions was the Hindu tradition from the Brahmanism, the Buddhist tradition and the Jaina tradition. And all three of those ultimately accepted the idea of karma, not in exactly the same way, but still recognizably similar kind of teachings of karma. So this idea that the Buddha is sort of determined by his cultural context, as well as being just an insult to the intelligence of the Buddha, is based on a complete lack of understanding of the complexity of the historical situation in the time of the Buddha. Questions?
How come? Well, I think So the question was, even though that these things talked about so much in the suttas, how can we have people who don't believe in those things? Well, I think it's very normal that when we're doing our spiritual practice that, you know, it's a gradual thing, and there are certain things we take up, certain things we practice, and certain things we accept, and certain things we don't, you know, and I think that's fine. I don't have a problem with that at all, right? I think people are evolving and changing, and, you know, I think somebody who rejects the idea of rebirth has perhaps thought about it more than someone who blindly accepts it without even considering what the implications might be. Right? I don't have a problem with that as such. I do have a problem with the idea that you can read it out of the suttas, right? That you can sort of dismiss it and say it's not actually found there. So, you know, I think if you don't believe in rebirth, fine. And if you disagree with what the Buddha said, it's fine. That's okay. People disagree with the Buddha all the time, right? He never said, oh, it's terrible, you shouldn't disagree with me, I'm right and you're wrong, right? He would have a conversation with them and he would try to persuade them, you know? So I think it's okay if you don't accept it, but just, you know, and I think that, you know, we'll look at the evidence more later on, but I think, you know, I do think that it's possible for an intelligent and sincere person to look at the evidence and come to different conclusions, right? I don't think the evidence is overwhelming in favour of rebirth. I think it's quite strong, but I don't think it's overwhelming. But in the case of what the suttas say, I think it's just overwhelming. I don't think it's possible to read the suttas sincerely and actually come to the conclusion that the Buddha wasn't talking about rebirth.
That's my point. So they then question the validity of the suttas. They question that it exists.
Well, it's kind of a combination, right? So it'd be a combination of both questioning certain passages as being whether they're authentic or not, and also interpreting things in a different way.
I also think some people just don't want to know.
Uh-huh.
It's too complex and too challenging.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Which again is understandable, right? So, you know, people should take up what's useful for them and what's beneficial. But I think you should do that with a bit of humility and say, well, this is what I want to practice for now, and then to stay open. Yeah. Okay? Anything else on this one before we move on? No? Okay?
I just want to point, and I'm sorry, I know I've talked a lot. Given that there's so many different types, how many times before that? There's so many different distinctions around.
Oh, different meanings of it, yeah.
And given that the Buddha thought very carefully about his enlightened being and came up with some answers and various approaches,
yeah.
Why then, 2,500 years later, are we still so confused to the point where we are unwilling to even believe in some of the things that the Buddha talked about? Why does it still remain such a mystery?
Look, I think the Buddha was so far ahead of his time. You know, I think he was. You know, the Buddhist tradition is like this kind of man sort of leapt, you know, so far ahead, and then the rest of the world's like, wow, they, you know, that's great, and they sort of. Slowly kind of inching forward to try to get, you know, a tiny bit of the way towards where the Buddha was. Yeah. Isn't it? And always it feels like it's, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Yeah.
I think there's an element, because the Buddha said don't believe anything I say, try it for yourself, and because it's impossible to find out yourself if reincarnation is true, and because none of us
It's not impossible.
Knows whether, know that anybody, because it's not actually proven in any overt sense, even the monks are not allowed to talk about their experiences, so it's just something that we have to take on faith, and therefore I think that we have permission to dismiss it.
Well, yeah, I think that's overstating it a bit. I think there are grounds for supporting the idea of rebirth, and we'll talk about them more in subsequent workshops. Okay, so I think there are actually strong grounds for that. Okay, but having said, you know, like I said, I don't think they're overwhelming grounds, and I can see how somebody would look at that and think, well,
you know, I'm not convinced. And I think that's fair enough. You know, I think at least give it a hearing. You know, I mean, it's interesting talking to Jim Tucker and to, you know, see his kind of slight frustration, a slight kind of resignation about, you know, working within the academic sphere and in Stevenson's research for, you know, so many decades, and how much work that they've done to establish this, which actually, I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot more evidence for rebirth than there is for, say, string theory, right? 11 dimensions and stuff. I mean, I understand that there are kind of mathematical and so on reasons for supporting string theory, but there's no actual evidence for it. And yet somehow string theory and, you know, multiverses and so on are acceptable scientific theories, whereas rebirth is really not. Yeah. Anyway, moving on, we're nearly out of time, so we've just got to get through our last few myths. Bastard. Okay. Consciousness enters the embryo at the moment of conception. Oops, I spelled conception wrong. Okay, what do sutras say, time, rebirth, attachment? Okay, so this is a bit related to that idea of the in-between state or the in-between process and so on and so forth. And there's a passage that talks about this in the suttas. But the main point that I just wanted to make here, I don't want to discuss this one in too much detail, or we don't have time to discuss it in too much detail, but basically the idea is that we don't have to think about these things in terms of moments, okay? We think about them in terms of processes. So the conception is not a moment, conception is a process. I'd like to talk about more about this later on, so I might just sort of beg your forgiveness of skipping over that one a little bit more briefly, and hopefully it will come up in some of the later workshops. Bastard. So transference of merit. What do the suttas say? Transference versus dedication. So this idea that you make an offering and then you transfer the merit to your dead relatives and so on and so forth, right? Now this is an idea which is mentioned a couple of times in the suttas, okay? We find it mentioned in verses in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Some other verses found in the Kuddhika Nikaya and so on. In fact, some of the verses that we recite, the Yathavarivaha, Pura Pariparenti, and so on, these verses are actually found in the canon. But it's certainly not a major feature of the Buddhist, you know, early Buddhist texts, and one could certainly suspect that the few verses that mention this kind of practice might have been later addition. I don't have any particular views about that, but it's certainly possible. One point, one sort of nuance to bear in mind is that the word we use today, usually to talk about, we sort of talk about transferring merit, as if you sort of, you know, you're emptying your own bank account to put it in somebody else's, right? Whereas actually the Pali word is udita, right, or udita, which doesn't really mean to transfer, but it means something like to dedicate, okay? So it means to direct. Actually, the word udita is related to the word disa, meaning direction, okay? So udita means to dedicate merit to somebody. So it's more about your own intention regarding the merit rather than like an actual transferring of it. Now, of course, the basic idea with karma is that karma is something which belongs to you. Karma sakon here, as we've said many times already. How can somebody else get the merit that you've been making, right? So generally speaking, you say, well, you can't really transfer your merit, right? But on the other hand, we're also not, we're not really completely separate from each other, okay? And when you know, especially if you're in a close group of people, like in a family or something like that, if one person does something good, that kind of tends to be a bit catching, doesn't it, right? Other people tend to be drawn along by that good, right? So there is a kind of a pattern or a draw or an affinity that moves in the direction of doing either good or doing bad, right? So I think there's something to this, like when we do that dedication of merit, that there's a memory of a family member or something like that, and a wanting to do something good in their name. Partly, of course, that has a very powerful positive impact on those family members who remain. And I think actually this is the main benefit of it, actually. Usually, or typically in the West, when somebody dies, you go mopey and sad and you all feel depressed and things like that, and you go and weep on each other's shoulders and you play sad music and things like that. When Ajahn Brahm started telling jokes in funerals, right, he'd be up the front telling a joke and all the people are sort of watching him, and the funeral directors were at the back of the room going, and he just ignored them and went ahead. Now he actually gets requests from people to tell jokes at their funerals, right? And they'll actually even request for specific jokes and things like that. And so from the Buddha's point of view, rather than kind of sort of dragging each other in the mire of getting grief and depressed about funerals, right? You think the idea is, let's do something good together, right? So the whole family comes together and actually does something. And so by that, you're empowering yourself. Like one of the biggest problems with death and the grief that comes from death is that you feel disempowered, right? Death is this force that none of us can win over, right? Yeah, you've got no power against death, so you feel, what's the point? You feel this kind of despair and so on. So by getting together with your family and your friends and going, making an offering in the name of the person who's passed away, you're creating a very positive force and coping with that grief, I think, in an extremely positive and healthy way. Can that actually benefit somebody who's departed? Well, one of the things that they say, and whether this is the case or not, I don't know, but the rationalization of it is that in most realms of existence, if people have died, then they cannot benefit from what you offer, okay? So if somebody's a dog, then you can offer, but they can't eat it because they eat dog food, right? If they're in heaven, they don't really care about your little stinky offering anyway, because they've got much better stuff up there, right? If they're in hell, what are they going to do? Say, excuse me, hell being, if you could let me out of this pot of boiling lead so I can go and enjoy a nice meal because my relatives... No, that's not going to work either, right? But there are some cases where people might be reborn in like the hungry ghost realm, where they maybe are still kind of hanging around, okay? So this is not necessarily in every case, but in some cases, maybe your relatives are still hanging around. And maybe they're hanging around because they feel very attached to their family. Maybe they feel very lost. Maybe they feel that you're kind of, you don't care about them, right? That you've forgotten about them, right? So when you make that offering in their name, right, then they'll feel happy because of that. They'll think, oh, they're being remembered. My family still love me. They're doing something good in my name. And so that being will then feel happy, a wholesome happiness and gladness because of that act that you're doing, right? It's not you're actually transferring your karma, but that it's like a mudita that they feel. So they're actually creating their own good karma at that time. And so that's the actual benefit that can happen. So this is how it's sometimes explained. So maybe that's one way of understanding it. But certainly, I don't think that you can kind of literally sort of transfer your merit from one to the other.
What about transferring merit to when you're still alive, and firstly on a personal basis, but also usually at the end of the retreat, you will dedicate some merit of the energy that you come with the retreat. You will dedicate it to either individuals or to groups of people.
Yeah. So I think you're creating a tendency in your mind when you do those things. Yeah. So like if you do like meditation, right? So you meditate, you're actually creating a very powerful positive consciousness inside yourself, right? And so then by doing that dedication at the end, to me the purpose of that is to say, look, I can now take this consciousness, which is now purified and energized and so on, and may I use this for the benefit of all beings. Yeah? So again, I don't think there's like a kind of mystical transference of energy. Having said which, right, I do think that we do interact with each other on energetic levels all the time, right? I mean, this is basic physics as well, isn't it? Our kind of gravitational fields are interacting and so on. And so I think our psychic fields are interacting. So by making these I think that there are connections between people that's happening all the time.
Yeah. There was a study that showed that
You include those people in your positive energy, not like I'm sending to you. You're thinking of them and bringing them to mind within your positive energy field.
Yeah, yeah.
Two groups of sick people. One group is told there's people praying for you, and the other group is told there's no one praying for you. And the people who thought that there were people praying for them had a better rate of recovery.
Was anyone actually praying? Were they praying for both groups?
I think they were just praying
for
the prayed
for group. Okay, yeah, look, there, I mean, there's been a lot of studies like that. Okay, so, Rohini. Strength of your intention is actually, in a sense, it's kind of magnifying your original good karma, right? Because you're saying, not only have I done this good thing, but I want to help others with it, right? So you're actually giving away your goodness, right? So there's actually more goodness in doing that, yeah? So, yeah, I do think you create a positive energy and things like that, but I don't think you can actually kind of literally transfer your karma to somebody else. Yeah, they will create their own good karma. Maybe they're affected by your energy or they're inspired by it or something like that, and so they can create their own good karma, and you can support them and help them to do that, right? But it's not like, you know, literally that you're giving your karma to them. Yeah.
Comes into the realm of universal consciousness. Because it just has to see as universal consciousness, and if you're giving with a selfless attitude, you're benefiting the whole realm.
Yeah. So it's interconnected. Yeah. I'll just move on quickly. We're just after 5 o'clock. So that one, plausible, half kind of. Yeah. bit of maybe, bit of not. Okay. Finally. You knew we had to go there, didn't we? Do we even need to talk about this? Right? I mean, FYI, you know, if you go to most traditional Buddhist countries and ask the women in those countries this question, they will say, yes, being born as a woman is because of bad karma. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Huh?
Anyone from traditional Buddhist background want us to dispute that? That's certainly the normal thing. Sorry, Rini?
I think sorry, is less
different. You think so? Being born as a woman is bad karma?
Well, I don't know, but I think it's high for women in a lot of things. So I don't know any karma or what.
Hmm. Okay. Anyway, so can I just before we go on?
Who died in the two world wars? More women have died in the last 100 years in childbirth than men who died because of bad maternal care. Thousands of
women.
Yeah.
Sorry. Right. Not everything is due to karma. Yeah. So let's just go on. First of all, what do the suttas say, right? So the suttas don't say anything about that or anything vaguely like that, right? So the suttas never, you know, they talk about karma so many times and different kinds of good karma and bad karma and so on that you can be making. And they never say that being reborn as a woman is a result of bad karma. On the contrary, the main tendency in the suttas is to downplay or dismiss the role of gender. So when the Buddha's asked if women can become enlightened, he said, yes, women can become enlightened. There's no kind of messing around with that. And the wonderful verses of the Arahant Bhikkhuni Vajira, who said that, Soma. Anyway, one of the Bhikkhunis who said that when accosted and insulted by Mara, and then she said, only Mara, you can talk to somebody who thinks of man or woman, but I don't think about man and woman. You know, my mind is in samadhi, my insight is flowing strongly. So, you know, you go off and talk to somebody who thinks in those kinds of terms. We also find the Buddha saying to King Pasenadi, when the King Pasenadi was told he had a daughter, he was very disappointed because he's a king, he wants to have a son. And the Buddha says, well, sometimes it's even better to have a daughter than to have a son. So the, you know, the overall tendency in the suttas is definitely to raise up and point to the equality of women and to downplay these ideas of the inferiority of women, which were very strong within the culture. Now, Ayesha pointed out earlier that in the Hindu tradition, that the Manusmriti and the other Dharma Shastras were instrumental in sort of codifying these kinds of attitudes, right? So the Manusmriti says that a woman must be dependent on her father when she's young, dependent on her husband when she's in middle age, and dependent on her son when she's older, and she should never be independent. And so these are the kinds of attitudes. But these Dharma Shastras were composed quite a few hundred years after the time of the Buddha, and of course also that these things represent the views of what men think should have happened. They don't necessarily represent the views of what actually did happen. Now, in India in the time of the Buddha, it certainly is the case that the women were disadvantaged. Perhaps the disadvantage wasn't as entrenched as it became later on. It's a bit hard to say. I'm not sure that we have enough evidence to be able to say clearly. But certainly what we can say is that within the Brahmanical tradition, within the Upanishads, that there are some very remarkable dialogues in the Upanishads where women play an extremely strong role. Okay, and this is not something which is kind of marginal. Actually, the most important one of the Upanishads, these are the most core of the whole non-dual tradition within Hinduism, right? The philosophical roots of the whole Hindu tradition. And the most important of the Upanishads is the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And in the Brihadaranyaka, there are two main core dialogues. And both of those dialogues were with a woman taking the role of the interlocutor in a very kind of powerful and strong philosophical role. So it certainly is not the case that sort of women were sort of systematically and completely excluded from the philosophical life and so on, as the impression that you might get from the later texts, right? Similarly, within the Jain tradition, that you had a very strong movement of women's renunciants, and the women were, the nuns' community of Jains were bigger than the monks' community, and this was despite the fact that the Jains did believe, if I'm not incorrect, I think that the Jain belief was in fact that rebirth as a woman was because of bad karma, but still the nuns far outnumbered the monks. And so when it comes to Buddhism, that the Buddha, I think, did his best to kind of overcome these kind of beliefs. And to me, what it comes back to is what I put there, you know, this whole thing, you know, the Buddha got enlightened, right? He went beyond everything. He went beyond good and evil, right? He went beyond the edge of the world, right? He went into perfection and to the end of where consciousness can take you. And what did he bring back from that place, right? After that whole journey of enlightenment, what does he bring back, right? Well, what he brought back actually was wisdom. What he brought back was compassion. What he brought back was freedom. What he did not bring back was stupid, dumb, harmful crap. Okay? The same bog ordinary, misogynist rubbish that you find repeated ad nauseum in every dumb, patriarchal, society or culture or whatever. And so, you know, for me, that's just it's so insulting and so painful to hear people attributing to the Buddha these kinds of ideas. You find a very interesting passage in one of the later texts. This is a Sanskrit text from, I can't remember the date, and it's a retelling of the story of the Mahaparinibbana, found in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when Ambapali, the courtesan, had invited the Buddha for a meal. That's a very nice thing. It's not an actual historically authentic telling, but it's a reinvention of it, and it shows how these attitudes were addressed in the Buddhist tradition. So what happened was that Ambapali went to the Buddha and invited the Buddha for a meal at her home the next day together with the Sangha, and the Buddha accepted. And she was then returning to her home, and along the way she ran up against the Lichavi youths. So this was in the kingdom or the republic of Vaisali, and the Lichavis were like the princes of that republic, and they were used to getting their way, right? And so this courtesan they met her and they said, oh, we're going to invite the Buddha for the dana tomorrow, okay? And Ambapali said, well, look, I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I've already invited him, okay? Bad luck. And they got really kind of angry, and they were snapping their fingers at her. That's what boxers do in the ring, right, in ancient India, to intimidate each other. They snap their fingers at them. So that's what they're snapping their fingers. You mango girl. And they said, in this particular version of it, they said, the Buddha spoke about the five flaws of women, right? The five things that are wrong with women. And they kind of listed all the five things that are wrong with women. And then they went off to see the Buddha, and they said, the Buddha, we want to invite you for the dana tomorrow. And the Buddha refused and said, I've already accepted the invitation from Ambapali. And then he went on to teach them the five good qualities of women. Right? So this is a very interesting text, right? And so what this text was alleging, essentially, is that all of these things talking about the faults of women and the bad karma of women and so on, that these were falsely attributed to the Buddha, and so the Buddha was actually the one who's giving that positive message.
What is that situation?
Like I said, it's not an early Buddhist text, it's a later one. It was one which was from one of these manuscript finds or something like that. I can't remember the details of it. But it's from like a Gandhari or Kharoshthi script or something like that. Yeah.
Okay,
no.
So it's not true that Ananda had to commit him?
No. We could be here for quite some time. So we should perhaps move on from that. But if you just want the TLDR version, that's no. Yeah. Bina. Yeah, that's something which is found mentioned a couple of times in the suttas, but there are good text-critical reasons for rejecting that as a statement of the Buddha. Often we find when that statement is found in a Pali text that it's not found in the corresponding Chinese text. Okay, there are also a number of problems with it. But one of the big problems with that particular text is, remember that one of the things the Buddha said was that everything that he taught from the time of his enlightenment to the time of his death was about suffering and the ending of suffering. Right, so he only talked about those things that are actually useful for leading to the ending of suffering. How is that useful for leading to the ending of suffering? I don't know. Nobody can become a Buddha, right? There's only the Buddha around. So to me, that particular statement is very suspect. But it's true that it is found in one or two places in the Pali texts. Yeah. Okay, we've run over time now. We should probably finish up. So I just want to, we should go just one double busted, okay? Sometimes just one busted isn't enough, okay? I'll just thank you all for your attendance and for your attention for today. It's been a wonderful workshop. And once again, to encourage you all to join up with the Discourse platform. So you can just Google Discourse sort of Central and then you should find it. Or go to my blog and you can find the link there. The URL is discourse.suttacentral.net.
and join up there, and then you can contribute, have a join the discussion, and we'll be putting the videos and various materials and things like that. But also encourage you to add your own materials if you know of any good writings on karma or readings, things like that, or if you know, I know that there are some like really good YouTube videos with some of the stories of reincarnation and things like that. So if you come across anything like that, then you can put them up there on the forum. And then we can have that kind of discussion. And that's also a way that, you know, we can sort of keep that alive. Also, it means while, you know, in the lead up to the next workshop, you can do the readings for the next workshop. And if you have questions about those, you can also put that there. And it means that we can keep contact with each other, but also means you can join in that conversation with the guys in Perth who will also be doing it. And there'll be also some other people following the course while overseas. So there's a kind of broader community of people who are also doing the course as well. So that's all good reasons for taking part in the forum.